In 1842, in his poem Ulysses, Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. I cannot rest from travel. I am a part of all that I have met. Yet all experience is an arch, wherethrough gleams that untraveled world, whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. This gray spirit yearns in desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. All experience is an arch, wherethrough gleams that untraveled world, whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. You know, if there were no other reason to live than to glimpse that untraveled world through the arch of our experience, it would be wonderfully worthwhile. But add to that the fact that no two of us sees the untraveled world, the future, and what it holds in the same way. We cannot, because no two of us is alike. In fact, there never have been two people who are exactly alike in all the millions of years of man's development, nor will there ever be, excluding single-egg twins, which are, in effect, one person in two bodies. In his excellent book, The Social Contract, Robert Ardrey gives us the reason that no two of us can be exactly alike. The principle is that of recombination. In the act of conception, two parents with different combinations of paired genes contribute half of the resources of each to what becomes a new genetic proposal. The fertilized egg, this randomly determined recombination of parental possibilities, is an accident of staggering possibilities. Theodosius Dobzhansky, an inheritor of Morgan's fruit flies, and today, philosophically, the most equalitarian of geneticists, has described the theoretical Mendelian consequences this way. If the parents have five pairs of genes, then there are 32 possible recombinations. If they have 20 pairs, then the possibilities amount to 1,048,576. If they have 32 pairs, then over 2 billion new opportunities confront the offspring. Yet the simplest of animals has genes in the hundreds, and the human being has far over 10,000. We have no comprehensible mathematics to describe the chance against recombination producing two identical human beings. It's a job even our most advanced new generation computers would just sit and short circuit over. Even in the case of brothers and sisters, the chance is one in a trillion that any two siblings will be genetically alike, even though they have the same parents. The accident, which determines in such large part what you or I will be, prohibits identicality. Every month, a new egg slips into the womb of the female of the species, and no two eggs are alike. Male sperm is produced in amounts beyond counting, yet no two are alike. And in the first trial of natural selection, there is no determination as to which sperm will have the superior luck or vigor to win the race to the egg and fertilize it. The magnitude of the competition is such that although only one human being will be the normal consequence of the achievement, still a single teaspoonful of male sperm would be sufficient to father every person alive on the earth today, and all would be different. Every human being conceived by sexual recombination is a genetic accident. Every individual being is thus a pioneer, a biological adventure, a brand new first-time person on earth. No one like you can exist in your species. Common heredity may provide a common disposition among contemporaries or a limited likeness between ancestor and descendant. But the strategy of sex denies the prison of identicality. If you were not created equal, and here we must ask equal to what or to whom, you were yet created free. So we stand, you and I, in the arch of our experience and face the untraveled world of tomorrow. Here it's good to remember the quotation from the book, The Nature of Man. Man tends to achieve his being inasmuch as he develops love and reason. Now, with these obviously great goals before us, the development of love and reason, and the awareness of the world of opportunity that lies before us, well, things can get much better and a whole lot more interesting. But, as Pierre Bertheau writes in The Future of Man, what is man and who is man? Whom and what do we mean exactly when we say that word? In this context, we normally mean the Western, white, civilized male adult, who is in fact only a very small percentage of the human race. Even if we consider, perhaps rightly, that this sort of human being outweighs in importance the rest of humanity. But if we take another index, for instance, a statistical one, we would would mean and consider as typical for mankind the largest race, age, and sex group. That is, young Chinese females. I like that quotation because, like a bucket of ice water in the face, it straightens us up, opens our eyes, and makes us see humanity from the standpoint of love and reason in an entirely new light. Our rewards will be in proportion to our service. We are here to serve other human beings. We will grow through the arch of our experience into the opportunities of tomorrow to the extent that we develop love and reason. Now let's look at our opportunities for what they really are. Not local or regional or national or continental, but global, universal. How can what we do help human beings everywhere on Earth, serve human beings everywhere on Earth, and do it from the standpoint of our originality as persons? It gives a whole new dimension to the word opportunity, doesn't it? But why then do we seem to move so tentatively, so fearfully, through the arch of our experience into the unknown? Russell has written that our instinctive emotions are those that we have inherited from a much more dangerous world and contain, therefore, a larger portion of fear than they should. We mentioned the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky. In his book, Man Evolving, he writes, "By changing what he knows about the world, man changes the world he knows. And by changing the world in which he lives, man changes himself." And Dr. Frederick L. Pollack, in his book, The Future of Man, writes, "Through his images of the future, we come to know man, who he is and how he wishes to be, what his thoughts are, what he values most highly, what he thinks is worth striving for, and whether he thinks it's attainable. Certain types of men hold certain types of visions, subject to their temper and spirit. Tell me what your vision of the future is, and I'll tell you what you are." Well, what's your vision of the future? Your future and the future of man. Do you believe that Harvey Cox, in his book, The Feast of Fools, that man is a transient eczema on a small planet in a third-rate galaxy? Or with Arthur Koestler in The Ghost in the Machine, that evolution has been compared to a labyrinth of blind alleys and is nothing very strange or improbable in the assumption that man's native equipment, though superior to that of any other living species, nevertheless contains a deficiency which predisposes him towards self-destruction? Both could be right. Lauren Eifley, in his book, The Unexpected Universe, writes, "The evolutionists, piercing beneath the show of momentary stability, discovered, hidden in rudimentary organs, the discarded rubbish of the past. They detected the reptile under the lifted feathers of the bird, the lost terrestrial limbs dwindling beneath the blubber of the giant cetaceans. They saw life rushing outward from an unknown center, just as today the astronomer senses the galaxies fleeing into the infinity of darkness. As the spinning galactic clouds hurl stars and worlds across the night, so life, equally impelled by the centrifugal powers lurking in the germ cell, scatters the splintered radiance of consciousness and sends it prowling and contending through the thickets of the world." We know that we become what we think about most of the time. Well, what do you think about most of the time? Repeating Dr. Pollack's quote, "Through his images of the future, we come to know man, who he is and how he wishes to be, what his thoughts are, what he values most highly, what he thinks is worth striving for, and whether he thinks it's attainable. Certain types of men hold certain types of visions, subject to their temper and spirit. Tell me what your vision of the future is, and I will tell you what you are." You can tell what you value most highly by assessing your past decisions, by seeing what you have, in fact, achieved, what you possess, what you place importance upon, what you felt has been worth striving for, what you wish to be, what you value most highly. When we look at ourselves in the light of our originality and realize we still cling to vestigial fears no longer needed, as useless as the disappearing limbs of the whale, as we stand in the arch of our experience and see the untraveled world before us, despite the nagging doubts that must plague us from time to time, I think we have to agree with Tennyson's Ulysses and say, "Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world." I got my inspiration for this piece when I reread one of the Markets of Change series, which appeared in 1970 in Kaiser News, published by Kaiser Aluminum and Chemical Corporation and edited by Don Fabin. That was one of the finest series of publications I've ever had the joy of reading, and I feel genuinely sorry for any person who did not have the opportunity to read and own them. The artwork and the typography were as great as the original in scholarly writing, and I've often wondered if Mr. Fabin and his friends went on to found a publication of their own once the series ended. In the one from which I took the quotation from Tennyson and some of the other quotes, which was on Ecology, number one of the Markets of Change series, 1970, it begins, "Once upon a time, there evolved upon this planet an organism that was ill-suited for survival. It could not run fast enough to escape its enemies. If caught, its teeth and claws were small protection. It was too big to hide under a leaf and too weak to burrow deeply into the ground. To survive, it took refuge in caves where a fire at the entrance kept predators at bay. If the fire ran out of fuel, this creature could hurl rocks and thus drive all but the most determined enemies away. Its security was measured by the amount of firewood it could accumulate and the number of rocks it could gather and store in the cave against the terrors of the night." Now, you see, this was a very important sort of thing. All other creatures grew bigger teeth or learned to run faster. Alone among all the creatures on Earth, the one we're describing turned to things for its survival. This was, in the end, to make all the difference. After a while, this creature learned to cultivate some edible plants to supplement the food it could get by gathering and hunting. Growing food was at best uncertain, and in any event depended on the seasons, which could not be controlled. And the creature began to store its surplus foods. His security against the vagaries of nature was measured by how much he could grow and how much he could store. His feelings for being at least partly in control of his destiny was based on the gathering of things. Well-being was measured quantitatively, the more the better. From the very beginning, he was motivated by fear of pain, fear of death, fear that there wouldn't be enough. In time, this creature's activities produced so much that it became more convenient to represent the accumulation of things by other things, smaller and easier to carry or to exchange. These symbols, although intrinsically of no value, assumed the same value as things, and men, or at least most men, became engaged in the acquisition and accumulation of the symbols of things. They did this even when they no longer had any need for them. The symbols were the surrogates for the rocks piled in the cave against the coming of the night. Now think of this system as being reinforced over and over through hundreds of generations and thousands of years through social approval, ritualization, and acculturation. That there was something basically wrong with this way of life may be exemplified by the fact that those who refused to subscribe to the accumulation and storage of things, Christ, Muhammad, Buddha, became the founders of the world's great religions. Well, the idea is not to stop collecting our rocks entirely, especially if we have families to think about, now and in the future. The idea is to collect our rocks wisely, or in these days, just collect a few. I attended a conference in Palo Alto, California recently, sponsored by the College of Financial Planners, of which I'm a regent, and where one of the excellent speakers, Mr. Philip L. Ramsdell, pointed out that 96% of the American people fail to achieve financial independence. The reasons for the virtual total state of impecuniousness rampant in the world's richest country are four. One, the high cost of living. That is, price and wage spirals, inflation. Two, the high cost of living high. Consumerism and the credit card society and philosophy, where people in the millions are searching frantically for things to buy instead of putting the same money to work in income-producing property or investments. Three, high taxes and multiple taxes and taxes on top of taxes, taxes which make our real take-home income look like a sheared sheepdog. A family finds it's earning $20,000 a year, according to the latest raise in pay. The man and his wife are ecstatic. What they fail to realize is that the raise in pay has only kept pace with the rising cost of living. But at the same time, the raise in pay has placed them in a new tax bracket. They're now paying more taxes on money, which does not constitute a raise in real pay at all. But they don't realize that, and they move to a larger house, basing their choice of home on the old funny multiple of four times annual income. But they think their annual income is $20,000 a year, when in actuality, it's more like $12,000. And they start living on $20,000 a year and trying to pay for it with $12,000. And it's then they find themselves getting behind what's known as the power curve, according to Mr. J. Chandler Peterson from Atlanta, an expert on financial planning. They find themselves borrowing money this year to pay last year's income taxes, then find that they have to pay this year's taxes, plus the amount they borrowed, plus the amount it takes to live on their new higher standard, which is based on the amount of money they're not really earning anyway. Add to this the higher cost of living, everything from schools and lawn tools to eggs and gasoline. Our new young executive with his Brooks Brothers suit and Sears Roebuck underwear finds that he's developed an entirely new capacity for sweating and lying with his eyes wide open in the dark. So number one is the high cost of living. Number two is the high cost of living high. Number three is high taxes. And number four, according to the very knowledgeable Philip L. Ramsdell, president of Combined Financial Corporation, headquartered in San Jose, California, number four is the high cost of leaving, which in all likelihood will bring Mrs. Executive face-to-face for the first time in her life with the cost of probate and the wolves of the IRS with regard to estate taxes. As one man at the conference put it, at one time we all lived in a large pasture in which we were free to frolic, work, eat, and reproduce. And then the government cut the pasture in half, and we found ourselves with less room to play in. Then it was cut in half again, and again, and again. Anyway, it's not too difficult to see why 96% of the American people wind up flat broke and disillusioned about how to play the collect the rocks for the cave game. Now, it's true that some people are able to collect these simple things, money, even when they no longer need it. But they constitute perhaps 0.5% of the population. And it's perhaps better to have a few more rocks than you need, since none of us knows for sure how long he's going to live and need them, than it is to run out of them entirely when we're 65 and still have 15 to 20 good years ahead of us. Let me try to remember an example of how what seems to look good can be something entirely different in reality. It was an example given by Mr. Chandler Peterson of Atlanta. Let's say you have $10,000 invested at 10% compounded, a very handsome rate of interest, you'll agree. That brings you a return of $1,000. But you're on the 50% tax bracket, which cuts that down to 500. Add state and local taxes, which take another 6% or 7% bite, and you've got 460 or something, and we're being very generous. The rate of inflation this past year was figured at 7%. Well, when Mr. Peterson got through, you had a net return on your 10% of $10,000 of, get this, minus 2.5%. What looked like a truly regal return on your money was in actuality putting you in the hole. That's why the majority of working people in our society have a negative cash flow. Earnings do not produce security. We need to put that $10,000 into a tax-deductible investment that will produce no current taxable income, that will produce tax-free buildup, and eventually, when we need it, a tax-favored payout, such as capital gains. In addition, we need an orderly method of transferring our estate at death through an IRS-approved investment and trust arrangement. But first, we need to find the income to work with our financial planner so that we can create a meaningful estate. And to do that, we must either augment our means or diminish our wants, as Ben Franklin suggested. We must live within our means, whatever those means happen to be. If we can theoretically afford to live in a $100,000 home, let's live in a $50,000 number and agree to apply the two-point common sense rule to everything we buy or want to buy. Whenever we find ourselves facing a buying situation, we test it against two questions. One, do I really need it? Is it necessary? And two, can I afford it? The second question should be based on an actual understanding of what our true income is after taxes, after expenses, and after provision for our future. At the seminar, a case was brought out about a high-income doctor who faced imminent bankruptcy. He was deeply in debt, owed last year's taxes, and was living beyond his means. Working with his financial planner, in 2 years he was debt-free and saving money the right way. It's seldom too late to get squared away, but we must guard against letting our living standard go up as our income goes up, because as a rule, it's not a real increase in income at all. It's just keeping pace with inflation and putting us in progressively higher income tax brackets. Albert Camus wrote in his notebooks, "It is a kind of spiritual snobbery that makes people think they can be happy without money." And if you don't think he's right, try it sometime. Ogden Nash in The Terrible People wrote, "Certainly there are lots of things in life that money won't buy, but it's very funny. Have you ever tried to buy them without money?" What do those who are trying to help the poor and the disadvantaged want? They want and need money. They clamor for federal and state money. They need federal and state money. But that money comes from hardworking people. It comes out of the money earner's pocketbook, whether it's a person or a company. All of it comes from taxes. We need to clean up the ghettos. It takes money to do it. We need to build whole new clean communities, better schools. We need to tear down the rat-ridden, mind-grinding, spirit-killing human dumps that exist in our big cities and replace them with cleanliness and order. It can only be done with money and more money. In Major Barbara, G.B. Shaw wrote, "The seven deadly sins, food, clothing, heat, rent, taxes, respectability, and children. Nothing can lift those seven millstones of man's neck but money, and the spirit cannot soar until the millstones are lifted." You know, millions live under the weight of a constant pressure, are torn by a ridiculous ambivalence that there's somehow something wrong with money, that money is evil, that to think about money, plan how to earn more money, indeed to earn a lot of money, is wrong somehow. It's often, strangely enough, good old mother who puts such thoughts into innocent young heads. As someone commented recently, the hand that rocks the cradle is also the hand that louses up Charlie. Yet that same mother would have been, and even may have been, in a heck of a fix without money for good shelter, warm clothing, good food, medical care, and some of the amenities of life. Getting back to G.B. Shaw, he also wrote, "Money is indeed the most important thing in the world, and all sound and successful personal and national morality should have this fact for its basis." Remember that, as Logan Pearsall Smith put it, there are few sorrows, however poignant, in which a good income is of no avail. The myth that there's something evil in money was put in the minds of the masses by those who had all the money. "Keeping poor and stupid, we'll stay rich," was the slogan of the rich in those days. Today we know that the best thing that can happen to people, to all of the people, is a measure of affluence, a substantial, more than adequate income. You know, Karl Marx's mother once said, if Karl, instead of writing a lot about capital, made a lot of capital, it would have been much better. There was a mother who knew what she was talking about. If all we did was sit under a tree and meditate and pass wisdom along to passing strangers, or wander the country teaching a better life with no wives, children, mortgages, taxes, dogs, schools, medical bills, automobiles, clothing, food, transportation, and clubs to concern ourselves about, we wouldn't have to pile rocks in our cave. But most of us seem to want these things, despite their onerous cost, and so maybe it's a good idea to find ways of having them without sweating ourselves into an early grave. While I was at the International Financial Planners Association conference in Palo Alto, I also ran across an interesting book for those who think the best way to augment their means is through a business of their own. The title of the book is Up Your Own Organization by Donald M. Dibble, who was at the conference and who gave me an autographed copy. As you might guess from the title, which is a play on Robert Townsend's book, Up Your Organization, Up Your Own Organization has an introduction by Robert Townsend, former chairman of the board of Avis Rent-A-Car Corporation. In his introduction, Townsend writes, "C. Northcote Parkinson is the discoverer of Parkinson's Law. Work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. He has also written about the automatic growth that takes place in organizations. For instance, he related the number of ships in the British Navy to the number of people working in their equivalent in the Navy Department. He discovered that when the number of ships began to decline, the number of people continued to grow. 10 years after that discovery, the number of ships is still declining, and the number of people in that department is still growing. When the British Empire began to dissolve, he discovered that the number of people employed to administer the affairs of the empire continued to grow. To this day, the number is still rising, even though the empire has disappeared. His most recent discovery is that if everything continues on course, by the year 2195, everyone in Britain will be working for the government. One of our large banks got interested in this, did some research, and came to the conclusion that if the trends of the last 10 years continue, everyone in America will be working for the government by the year 2049. Now, that's less than 80 years from now. Meanwhile, the concentration of economic power continues. Anthony Jay, in his new book, Corporation Man, published by Random House, concludes, "It seems almost inevitable that, well before the end of this century, most of the wealth of the Western world will be controlled by 300 to 600 giant international corporations. The only argument now is about the exact number." And Townsend goes on to say, "As an escapee from both the American Express Company and the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, as a longtime non-admirer of big government, and as an ardent lover of human beings as individuals, I must confess that I'd almost rather see the kids reduce the country to rubble than see it pass into the clammy hands of a few hundred politicians and top corporation executives. The only thing standing in the way may be the person with enough guts to chuck security and start his own business. This book, Up Your Own Organization, is for that person. To me, he and his ilk are the last remnants of humanity, the only real human beings left. This book is for the individual who has been wondering for a long time whether life has to be the way it is in that big organization he or she works for. 10% chicken salad and 90% chicken you-know-what. Wouldn't it be fun," asks this individual, Robert Townsend writes, "to see if we could start a new company dedicated to chicken salad. Chicken salad for the customer, for all the shareholders, and for the employees, most of whom will be shareholders too." On the plane flying back to Florida from San Francisco, I did a pretty good skimming job on Mr. Dibble's book, and if you've tried with the idea of joining the drawn-faced, hollow, staring-eyed, trembling-hands group known as entrepreneurs, who sometimes get very rich, and sometimes work their you-know-what-off for 40 years for less money than they could have made if they'd stayed at old ABC Company in a 40-hour week, and who sometimes end up in bankruptcy, by all means buy and read Up Your Own Organization by Donald M. Dibble, published by Hawthorne Books. As the late Vince Lombardi once said of the forward pass in football, only four things can happen to a forward pass, and three of them are bad. Going into business for yourself is on the same order, but what would football be without the forward pass? And what would this country be without entrepreneurs? The definition of entrepreneur is one who assumes the risk and management of business, an enterpriser. And I read in Ethics, the International Journal of Social, Political, and Legal Philosophy, published by the University of Chicago Press, in an article, Kierkegaard, The Self and Ethical Existence, by George J. Stack of the State University of New York, a quotation of Kierkegaard that should make us all stop and think. He said, "There is nothing of which every man is so afraid of as getting to know how enormously much he is capable of doing and becoming." There is nothing of which every man is so afraid of as getting to know how enormously much he is capable of doing and becoming. And then Stack writes, "One can refuse to seek self-knowledge, can live an unexamined life, or can fall into moral indifference. But the life of such a being is not the life of a person, nor of an authentically existing individual." And again he wrote, "Not to take up responsibility for oneself is to lose the possibility of being a self. And by coming to know the actual self as far as this is possible, one accepts responsibility for what one has been, and one is now capable of deliberate choice. Choice integrates the various aspects of the self, unifies and consolidates the diverse, often contradictory tendencies of the potential self." Well, that's a tremendous article. I wish we could give you the whole thing. If you write to the University of Chicago Press, I'm sure they can supply you with a copy, and I think you'd enjoy Ethics as much as I do. In another place, Professor Stack writes, "One of the most primitive forms of self-alienation is manifested when an individual does what they want him to do. They meaning significant others, dominant or influential others, even though it's something which he consciously does not want to do." Perhaps we should hit those points in order. First, it's by finding ourselves that we can come to know how enormously much we're really capable of doing and becoming. It is not by acting a part, trying to live like other people, living a second-hand and derivative life, that we come to know our real powers. It's by finding ourselves. It's by examining and exploring ourselves and taking full responsibility for ourselves. Not to take up responsibility for oneself, as Professor Stack writes, is to lose the possibility of being a self. And by coming to know the actual self as far as this is possible, one accepts responsibility for what one has been, and one is now capable of deliberate choice. Choice integrates the various aspects of the self, unifies and consolidates the diverse, often contradictory tendencies of the potential self. And one of the most primitive forms of self-alienation, of cutting ourselves away from the real and powerful person we truly are, comes about when we do what they want us to do, even though it's something we consciously do not want to do. In another part of the article, Professor Stack writes about the importance of choice and says we do not deliberate about driving our car from one place to another, from our place of work to our home. We simply do it voluntarily. There are, however, specific moments when we're confronted with choices which we know will have important ramifications for our lives. A person may ask himself, should I pursue this career or that? Should I live in accordance with ethical categories or not? Should I marry or not? Should I serve in combat in time of war, or should I be a conscientious objector? Should I believe in the existence of God or not? There are some options which one encounters which are, as William James pointed out, momentous options for ourselves. And the important thing is to choose. Since this resoluteness is an affirmation of one's self, an expression of one's individuality, irresolution is either an incapacity to choose or an unwillingness to choose. What is lacking is serious or passionate concern. The great quotation by Emerson popped into my mind. He said, "What a new face courage puts on everything." It's by having the courage to make the decisions that represent our real gut choices, to take responsibility for our decisions in our lives, that we will find our true powers. As Mumford writes, The great mass of comfortable, well-fed people of our civilization live lives of emotional apathy and mental torpor, lives of enfeebled desire, second-hand lives. And he said, the Greeks had a word for this pallid simulacrum of real existence. They called it Hades. I think it can be said that the great majority of people do not really live as we like to think of that word at all. They spend their lives as puppets with the strings in the hands of they. What they say, what they think, how they live. George Stack reminds us that Socrates held that it is by no means necessary that everyone become a man. And Kierkegaard held that it is by no means necessary or inevitable that one become a person or an integral self. The act of choosing is not only individuating, but it's an act whereby the individual both expresses and attains freedom. The primitive freedom an individual has is the freedom for possibility. Before William James, Kierkegaard insisted that only in a world in which there is possibility is freedom itself possible. And he writes, an individual who chooses himself ethically, chooses himself as this concrete individual who exists here and now, and whose present existence has been shaped by causal factors which he appropriates, that this the individual becomes conscious of himself as this definite person with these talents, these dispositions, these instincts, these passions, influenced by these definite surroundings as this definite product of a definite environment. But being conscious of himself in this way, he assumes responsibility for all this. Having freely chosen what has been, as it were, imposed upon him, the individual is now able to bear responsibility for what he does with these inherited dispositions, these psychological tendencies or characteristics. Freedom is not, as it was for Spinoza, the recognition of necessity, but it is manifested in and made possible by the appropriation of necessity and possibility. Human freedom is not given as such, except as a possibility that may be actualized. It is the finite freedom of a person who is shaped and influenced by some circumstances which are outside his power. Man is determined in his being, but determining in his becoming. Choosing oneself as determined is a condition for the possibility of realizing oneself as free for possibilities positive for oneself. And not to act on a possibility is to run the risk of losing that possibility as possibility. And I've long been of the opinion that trying to play it too safely is about the best way in the world to remove most of all possibility from our lives and end by missing the boat, by missing ourselves and our powers. Dr. Frederick S. Perls agreed with this idea, too. His book, Gestalt Therapy Verbatim, is one of the most charming, educating, and refreshing books I've read in a long time. I've become a fan of Gestalt Therapy, and as he points out in the frontispiece, to suffer one's death and to be reborn is not easy. I think we do this when we shrug off the phony life imposed upon us by others and the environment as much as we can, and take responsibility for ourselves and our future. The prayer in Gestalt Therapy is great. It goes like this. I do my thing, and you do your thing. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you are not in this world to live up to mine. You are you, and I am I. And if by chance we find each other, it's beautiful. If not, it can't be helped.